Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
WRIF.com.
Award-winning night call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Yeah, welcome. Pleasure to be here with you. Yeah, get those numbers. I guess there's only one, but we got a lot of lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. We're always completely open line, which means you can respond to anything that I say, or you can bring up things that you like as well. So, and that particularly goes out to every once in a while I'll get a complaint from, and the complaint department, I guess it's always open. I'd like to say it's never open, but it's always open. 313-298-WRIF. Actually, the complaint department is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. But here's the deal. If you don't like what I'm saying, or you don't like what I'm talking about, or if you don't like what the last caller's talking about, the lines are open. I mean, we screen the calls. Brandon's there doing it. And he'll get your calls at 313-298-WRIF. But you can change the subject, and we don't say, well, no, we're talking about this question be solved in this manner or not. We don't do that. We just get you on. We're all ADD on this bus, so don't worry about it. Let's see. Well, yeah, the Iraq War entering its fourth year. Yeah, I was just thinking, World War II, United States was in World War II from December 1941 to May, isn't that right? May 1945. So it's about 3.5 years. So we're starting to approach that. Although, I mean, how would you calculate the Vietnam War? In some ways, 14 years, 1961 to 1975. Or when did, now maybe we started getting the troops out. I can't remember. Like, or 72. But anyways, it was long. It was America's longest war and the only war that the United States has lost so far. But George W. Bush may have gotten us into another one, which the United States will lose as well. Now, things aren't, well, let me put it this way. The White House is disputing that Iraq is sinking into a civil war. They say no. I mean, 45 people died today in sectarian violence, folks killing one another, but that's not a civil war. And, in fact, the fellow who was the prime minister, Ayad Alawi, he said, if this is not civil war, then God knows what civil war is. But Vice President Dick Cheney asked about Alawi's remarks. He was on, where was he? One of those talking head shows on Sunday morning. He said, no, it's, this is from an impeccable source. Remember, it was Cheney that said that the insurgency is in its last throes. They launched 34,000 attacks last year. The insurgents launched 34,000 attacks. And this is absolutely incredible. Let's see. Yeah, so Cheney has a good record of predicting. I mean, he was the guy that said there were nuclear weapons there. He was saying that we'd be welcomed by the Iraqis and all that. You know, I received this email from Kerry W. Dixon. He said, wait a minute. Why? I thought you didn't give whole names. Well, I'll tell you. You'll figure it out in a while. And Kerry W. Dixon sent an email to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and the subject line was Dick Cheney the moron. So naturally, I opened it, right? And it's an ad for Viagra and Valium and Xanax. You know, one of those things are online pharmacies. I don't even know whether you get it. Hey, if you're ringing, hold on, and just keep ringing, and Brandon will pick it up. Oh, I want to talk about something else. I forgot about that as well. So this is shows you the extent of the unpopularity of Bush Co. and all of these folks in Washington. They can actually put this up there, Dick Cheney the moron, and I go, okay, I'll open that. Our producer, Jay Hudson, he's taking it easy. He just had his nipples pierced. That sounds like a good idea to me. Let's get our nipples pierced. Maybe I'll do it next week. Well, I don't know. Maybe not. Anyways, he said it was quite a hit. Quite a hit when they pierced him. I guess they must have done it one at a time. I can't believe they did them simultaneously. So now he's got two rings through his nipples, and I was thinking, I don't know if that's the best idea. I mean, I'm sure it serves some sensual purpose, but you could never get away from your lady or your man, right? I mean, they would just say, come here, just pull him, and you'd have to come with him, whether you like to or not. So Jay's taking it easy. He's also going to do overnights. He's the co-host of Motor City Riffs, which... in Detroit, in the WRF listening area, precedes this show. So Bush marked the anniversary. He said things are going swimmingly, although he never uttered the word war. We are implementing a strategy that will lead to victory in Iraq. Yeah, I sure. Now, here is Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld. Now, you think I'm just being disparaging when I call him the Secretary of War. I mean, talk about incompetence. This is the guy that planned everything, right, and screwed up everything. Why is he still there? I mean, how can you, boy, I almost said it, screw up, you know, the word that you would say instead of that badly? He wanted to fight the war on the cheap, not have a lot of soldiers there. I mean, the people that said, hey, we're going to need about 300,000 troops, and he's fired that general. Anyways, Secretary of War, that's what the position was called up until, I think, 1945. I don't have this in front of me. But all during World War II, for instance, that post was called the Secretary of War. And so I think it's appropriate. I mean, it's kind of BS to call it the Defense Secretary. It's not about defense at all. It's about war. Anyways, Rumsfeld, always wrong about everything. And I don't know. I mean, I'm saying this sort of flippantly. People have died. Tens of thousands of people have died. I mean, probably, who knows, way over 100,000, including 2,309 Americans as well, because he made a miscalculation. And as I've said a lot of times before, these are guys that are so wealthy, so positioned, so privileged, that when they screw up big time, I mean, tens of thousands of people dead is big time screw up. You and I, we screw up a little, that's our ass. Right? We get fired, or we get divorced, or you know, something like that. I mean, we always pay the cost. We overspend, for instance. We ruin our credit. We have to go bankrupt. We always pay the cost because we're the common people. But these rich ruling elites, like the Secretary of War Rumsfeld, they never pay the cost. They're, you know, what they say, I'm paying the cost to be the boss. Well, they're not paying anything. They're taking. They're multimillionaires. Secretary of War Rumsfeld just increased his stock tremendously by this, what's it called? Not Thermaflu, Tamiflu. Because people went on this panic buying about this anti-flu medicine. People are afraid of the avian flu. And so this guy's got dozens of, I wouldn't say dozens, but he owns at least a dozen homes. And it doesn't matter. He'll be back. Next time there's Republican ministry, say, aren't you the guy that, and they go, oh yeah, well, come on in. And the people's memories go back about a week. So it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that these guys were all involved in the miscalculations of the 80s that cost a couple hundred thousand civilian lives in Central America. People are going, Central America? What the hell? Did we fight a war in Central America? Go read about it. Anyways, here's what the Secretary of War says. This is a column for the Washington Post. Now is the time for resolve, not retreat. Onward. Yeah, not him, not anybody he knows. No, there ain't any rich kids out there in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, maybe one or two, but not very many. Turning our backs, this is what he says, turning our backs on post-war Iraq today would be the modern equivalent of handing post-war Germany back to the Nazis. Bad analogy, because here's a man that has all these corporate connections. This is how he got wealthy, like Cheney. And, of course, it was the American corporations that were so instrumental in building the Nazi war machine, the Wehrmacht, in the 1930s, right? Henry Ford was a big pal of Hitler. Hitler always kept a little portrait of Henry Ford the first. In fact, even on his bunker in Berlin at the end. And General Motors, IBM, the Ethel Corporation, Standard Oil, all of them. They all contributed. In fact, the World War II probably wouldn't have been possible if it hadn't been for American corporation support of the Nazis. And, I mean, the invasion of Russia began with Standard Oil diesel. And during the war, there's an incredible book called Trading with the Enemy that talks about how all these companies continued to supply Nazi Germany, American corporations, through these neutral companies. After the war, the United States had bombed all these factories, like Opel, which was a General Motors subsidiary, and General Motors applied for war reparations, saying, you bombed our plants in Germany, and they got money for it. It's a horrid story. And all these corporate leaders were way pro-Nazi. They went to parties at the Nazi embassies. This is 1938, 1939, 1940. The Second World War had already begun. They just thought it was absolutely great. And they were way down with Munich. Remember when they told Hitler to go ahead that you could gobble up Central Europe? I mean, that wasn't cowardice. It wasn't, you know, Munich has become kind of this code word for giving in to a dictator when you shouldn't. But it was all part of their strategy. For one thing, A, they supported the Nazis, and B, they were banking on that, they were only half right, that the Nazis would turn on the Soviet Union. So they wanted that to happen. They wanted the Nazis to attack the Soviet Union, which they did. It was a terrible war. I mean, sort of like Reagan and the first President Bush encouraging Iraq and Iran to fight one another. Well, the same thing happened. Except it turned on its head. The Red Army, the Soviet Union, essentially won the Second World War in Europe, right? I mean, the United States, Britain were just kind of afterthoughts, and they said, whoa, man, the Soviet's going to wind up at the Atlantic Ocean. We better get in there. We better make all these deals. I mean, they were playing from a pretty weak hand. Again, they made this strategic error. Rather than starting a second front in Europe, they said, we're going to attack Italy. You know, I mean, all these things are portrayed as like the United States saved the war. The United States and Britain did not have to even invade France, you know, D-Day, Normandy, and all that. That was purely political so that the United States and Britain could have a role in deciding what was going to happen in Europe. For instance, in Europe, the United States lost 100,000 men. You think that's gone? It's incredible. 100,000 men in the battle that they fought from June 44 up to May 45. The Soviets lost 100,000 men in the battle for Berlin. They inflict 90%. They inflicted 90% of the casualties that the German Nazi army suffered. So, all right, am I way off on it? Yeah, I am. All right, so Rumsfeld, shut up, man. Just shut up. You know, I want to, it's come to this, too. I mean, everything that I said that sounded so off the wall and so radical a few years ago, now everyone's saying it. Bob Herbert, who's an op-ed columnist in the New York Times, says, stop Bush's war. By some estimates, he writes, according to a recent article in Foreign Affairs, the number of Iraqis who have died as a result of the U.S. invasion has reached six figures. Vastly more have been killed by all, that's a figure, vastly more than have been killed by all international terrorists in all of history. So we're trying to, you're saying you got to break a few eggs and make an omelet. Well, I mean, you're destroying the farm here. So the United States has killed more civilians in Iraq than terrorists have killed in all of history. This is, and this isn't Bob Herbert. This is these prestigious foreign affairs guys doing it. And here's what it's devolved down to. Jeffrey Gettleman of the New York Times, in his article recently, says in Sadr City, the Shiite section in Baghdad, where the four terrorist suspects were executed, that's what these people did, government forces have vanished. The streets are ruled by aggressive teenagers with shiny soccer jerseys and machine guns. They set up roadblocks and poke their heads into cars and detain whoever they want. Mosques blare warning on loudspeakers for American troops to stay out. Increasingly, the Americans have been doing just that. So things aren't going very well, regardless of the people that lied to us right along. And to give you an idea how isolated, so I'm right after the war began, and there was huge support for it and all that. I mean, it's people like myself and people that knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They knew there was no connection with 9/11. Felt pretty isolated. All of the media repeated the lies and uncritically, even though the critics were there. They ignored it, and they just reported the most absurd statements that have all turned out to be lies on the part of the Bush administration. Now it's on television. And I'd like to, and I want to play something for you. And it's from Boston Legal. My wife watches it all the time. She said the most astounding end to this episode just occurred. And I went, yeah. And here's the deal. I'm going to set this up. This is about 4 or 5 minutes long. James Spader, who plays Alan Shore, the partner of William Shatner, the Denny Crane character. I mean, this may, you know, I've never even seen a whole episode. So stay with me. But I want to just show you that the depth to which the opposition has gone to Bushko's war. Now, what's happened is that Alan Shore, the character in Boston Legal, his secretaries refused to pay her taxes to the United States because she said she doesn't support the war and she doesn't support the government. She's indicted, as you can imagine, and Alan Shore defends her. So what we're going to hear at the beginning is the prosecutor summing up, saying why she must be convicted, and then Alan Shore's response. So this is Night Call. If you'd like to call in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF. And there's more to it than this, at least in terms of what I want to say about it after. And I would encourage you to comment as well. So this is from Boston Legal on WRIF.
Clearly, she committed a crime. She didn't pay her taxes. The only question is, will you hold her accountable? Now, no doubt Mr. Shore will try to paint her some kind of activist hero. But she is no hero, folks. At a time when freedom has never been more precarious in this country, for her to refuse her civic and legal duty to pay her taxes while we have soldiers dying over there, this woman's deliberate action is as unpatriotic, as un-American as it is illegal. This is the cut-and-run behavior of a coward. Don't you dare declare her a hero.
when the weapons of mass destruction thing turned out not to be true, I expected the American people to rise up. They didn't. Then, when the Abu Ghraib torture thing surfaced, and it was revealed that our government participated in rendition, a practice where we kidnap people and turn them over to regimes who specialize in torture, I was sure then the American people would be heard from. We stood mute. Then came the news that we jailed thousands of so-called terrorist suspects, locked them up without the right to a trial or even the right to confront their accusers. Certainly, we would never stand for that. We did. And now it's been discovered the executive branch has been conducting massive illegal domestic surveillance on its own citizens, you and me. And I at least consoled myself that finally, the American people will have had enough. Evidently, we haven't. In fact, if the people of this country have spoken the messages, we're okay with it all. Torture, warrantless search and seizures, illegal wiretappings, prison without a fair trial, or any trial, war on false pretenses. We as a citizenry are apparently not offended. There are no demonstrations on college campuses. In fact, there's no clear indication that young people even seem to notice. Well, Melissa Hughes noticed. Now, you might think, instead of withholding her taxes, she could have protested the old-fashioned way, made a placard and demonstrated at a presidential or vice presidential appearance. But we've lost the right to that as well. The Secret Service can now declare free speech zones to contain, control, and in effect, criminalize protest. Stop for a second and try to fathom that. At a presidential rally, parade, or appearance, if you have on a supportive t-shirt, you can be there. If you're wearing or carrying something in protest, you can be removed. This in the United States of America. This in the United States of America. Is Melissa Hughes the only one embarrassed?
Mr. Shaw, that's a chair for witnesses only.
Really long speeches make me so tired sometimes.
Please get out of the chair.
Actually, I'm sick and tired.
Get out of the chair.
And what I'm most sick and tired of is how every time somebody disagrees with how the government is running things, he or she is labeled un-American.
Evidently, it's speech time.
And speech in this country is free, you hack. Free for me, free for you, free for Melissa Hughes to stand up to her government and say, stick it.
Objection.
I object to government abusing its power to squash the constitutional freedoms of its citizenry. And God forbid anybody challenge it. They're smeared as being a heretic. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American.
Mr. Shaw, unless you have anything new and fresh to say, please sit down. You've breached the decorum of my courtroom with all this hooting.
Last night, I went to bed with a book. Not as much fun as a 29-year-old, but the book contained a speech by Adlai Stevenson. The year was 1952. He said, "The tragedy of our day is the climate of fear in which we live, and fear breeds repression. Too often, sinister threats to the Bill of Rights, to freedom of the mind, are concealed under the patriotic cloak of anti-communism." Today, it's the cloak of anti-terrorism. Stevenson also remarked, it's far easier to fight for principles than to live up to them. I know we are all afraid. But the Bill of Rights, we have to live up to that. We simply must. That's all Melissa Hughes was trying to say. She was speaking for you. I would ask you now to go back to that room and speak for her.
You listen to WRI of the Night Call Show. Peter Werbe here with you. Just heard about a five-minute segment from Boston Legal. I think that was like March 12th. And that was James Spader playing Alan Shore in defense of a secretary who had refused to pay her taxes. And there's a couple of things. It's extraordinary that actually when I was doing a national show 3-4 years ago, I lost affiliate after affiliate for saying those same things. And so did the other people on the network I was working on. Now it's stuff of mainstream television. So I think that in itself is extraordinary. I mean, you know why the fascists hate Hollywood, right? It's because they tell the truth. You know, the Harry Truman, they say, give him hell, Harry. One time he responded, he says, I don't give him hell. I just tell the truth, and they think it's hell. Because they're always acting under lies. If they say it's Sunday, we got to look at the calendar. Now, here's what I think is extraordinary as well. There's hardly anybody left except for those people who, if they saw films of George W. Bush practicing cannibalism, would still support him. Those are the only people left that support the war. I mean, they're in a major polemic against reality. Nobody thinks it's going well. Everybody thinks it was a mistake. I mean, the majority of people, majority. And yeah, I was there. So I'm not trying to, send you, if you still, you're one of that third that's left. I'm not trying to send you off to the hottest room in hell, although you tried to do that to me. And you tried to sink my shows and stuff like that. That's not what I do. But anyway, so here's the third anniversary of the war. There's international demonstrations called, and they took place. I actually, I'm such an activist nut that I went to two of them. I went to one out in Northville. It's a little Republican town, west of here. And there was almost 200 people there, and then I went downtown Detroit, and there was about 300 people there, about 4:30. And both of them were lively, both of them had a presence, I would say, overwhelmingly in both areas that people the going by and in cars responded positively. And yet, I mean, let's face it, they were pathetically small. And it was true even in places where, like in London, I forgot what the figures were, but they said there was 15,000. And, you know, oftentimes this is, you get these figures from the officials, so I'm not real solid on them, but they were diminished. I don't think there's any way to get around that. I thought they'd be enormous because you would think so. Like when I was, my wife and I went to New York City on February 15th, 2003. Right before the war began, there's a million people out there. One city. This was, and there was, I forgot what, it was 10, 12 million people demonstrating around the world. So what's going on here? I talked to someone here, a colleague, who thinks the war is horrible and that Bush is terrible. And she said, well, people just think that demonstrations aren't effective. I mean, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, believe me, if there would have been 5,000 people came out in Northville, and there would have been properly 20,000 people in Detroit, it would have had an impact. So we know from the figures, it's out there. I listen to you folks. I talk to people nationally, and there's this great desire to stop this war, to still the hand of Bush, to bring some sense back to this country. And so where were people? I don't know. I mean, we know, for instance, that culturally it's still happening. This movie, V for Vendetta, which was the top grossing film of the weekend, is essentially for freedom against fascist tyranny. And this is a wonderful quote from, it's on my website, peterwerbe.com. Last name, peterwerbe.com. By the way, you can go to the site and you can, I was going to put a link to download it. But anyways, it's the Boston Legal thing that I played is on there. But the quote from V for Vendetta is, people should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. And I got under it. Let's make it so. Now, that's what's happening in France. There was this little minor change in the employment law. You can't like in countries like France, like you can't hear, you can just fire people willy-nilly, right, unless there's a union contract, and not many of us left in unions. And there, though, they wanted to make it easier for employers to fire people. Well, it's like 1968 again. Millions of people, a couple million people protested nationwide against this law, half a million people turning out in some of these demonstrations, and the head of the union saying, if they don't listen to us, we're going to have to think about moving to a general strike across the entire country. The protesters, according to this New York Times account, want the abolition of a new law known as the First Employment Contract, set to take effect in April, that would allow employers to fire new workers under the age of 26 without cause for 2 years. I mean, once they're in there for 2 years, they got, you know, they're kind of there. But students joined forces with teachers, workers, retirees, opposition politicians, and labor union leaders in more than 150 cities and towns throughout France on Saturday in the largest nationwide protest against the government's new youth labor law, the first time this has happened since 1968. So it's possible to do this stuff. And you know what? The government is going to back down. And you know why? Because just like this quote said from V for Vendetta, this government is now afraid of their people. Here, we're afraid of our government. And in two ways. I mean, there's actually fear of repression and the kind of fascistic tendencies, the fascistic tendencies inherent in these people that have no respect for democratic principles whatsoever, that are shredding the Constitution, but also we're afraid in the sense that we don't think our capacity as citizens in a democratic country will have any effect. They're not afraid of us. They're laughing at us. They're laughing at you. If you're patriotic, they're laughing at you. If you support the war in Iraq, they're laughing at you. All right, Peter Werbe here with you on Night Call. 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back, and man, we got the calls already.
This is WRIF.com.
Yeah. while since I could look at myself straight, and it's been a while since I said I'm sorry.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Let's go right to our phones. Man, you guys want to talk about everything under the sun. And I say guys because no gals on there, so we don't do any gender discrimination here. If you'd like to call, do it, 313-298-WRIF. Email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And actually, there's tons of good stuff on there this week. Here's Daryl in Romulus. Daryl, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Well, as of the 15th, we got notified that our facilities are closing down in the whole United States nationwide.
Who's that now? What company?
API. What we did there, we processed packages for the U.S. Post Office.
Right.
Shipping and handling and all that type of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And the people out in corporate, the company, they bought up another company, and the guys that do the number counts.
Yeah, the bean counters.
Yeah, the bean counters.
Right.
This figure showed that we were making a profit, and the big investors pulled out. So as of this past Thursday at 12 o'clock our time, they filed Chapter 11.
Wow. Well, how come, like Bush says, the economy is going great. He says, here's a quote. Bush says, we're doing fine, and the stock market's up. And why can't these companies like General Motors and, why do I keep blocking on that parts manufacturer? What the hell is Delphi? And your company, what's going on? Who's making the money? I don't understand this.
I have no idea, but throughout the whole nation, we got 45 facilities. That means 45 different states.
They're called, well, who's going to pick up, who's going to do this for the post office?
I have no idea.
Wow.
But 3,000 people are going to be losing their jobs. As of our plant is going to be shut down Wednesday. The reason why we're working right now is we are committed to get the packages out that's in our computer system. And we say it's not fair to leave the consumer, leave the people that already bought their packages in trailers, and we decided to kick it all out.
That's terrible. That's absolutely terrible. I don't even know what to say, Daryl, except it's part of a pattern, obviously. I mean, and that doesn't do you much good. It's not going to do you much good when you got to pay rent or the mortgage payment or the car payment.
Exactly. That's where, exactly, because my position, I 5 years ago, I got laid off from another facility, another plant, and they went belly up, but another company bought them out, so I was able to save all those people's jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 5 years later, it's happened all over again. I can't get past the five-year mark. It's like deja vu all over again. 5 years later, they're closing the doors, 3,000 people are being let go.
Wow. Well,
that's between our truck drivers. That's between our line workers.
You. I just don't, there's not much to say because there's not the ability to respond in any mass way. So it's just each individual is screwed by this huge corporate entity.
Exactly. And the corporate people, they don't care. They don't care about the working man. Only thing they want to do is make their money. And the heck with the workers.
Right. Well, they have their sole commitment is to their stockholders who, the major ones are, of course, extraordinarily wealthy. Well, Daryl, I'm sorry to hear it, but I'd like to hear from other people about it as well. So thanks for calling. And, all right. I appreciate it. You have a good one. I was looking for, this says the average American family has taken a financial tumble and millions in this country go hungry. This is true. People go, and they're not starving. There's a difference between being hungry and starving to death. There's people in this country that are going hungry, despite Bush's sunny assessment of the U.S. economy, say federal data and economists. I'm trying to see where this was in here, where I can't, Well, anyways, we were at the aggregate income of all of us has let me get this right. That's why I like to read stuff. It depends on where you are. The middle class and below has lost income in the period where Bushco is in there, this racket posing as a government that's just taking money out of our pockets and giving it to the corporations and the wealthy. Let me see. Oh, the Federal Reserve reported that average incomes after adjusting for inflation actually have fallen between 2001 and 2004. And so you can say, well, I'm making more money. You may be. Am I? Yeah, I think I'm making a little more. So I can say, oh, well, that's not true. I'm making a little more. But that's not what it's all about. It's, hello, average. And what does that have to, how does that manifest itself? One of the things, there is this new book out. Let's see if I can find it quickly. Kevin Phillips was this conservative. I think he worked in the Nixon administration even. And he wrote this strategy for the Republican Party on how it could become the powerful and dominant party in the United States. And now he is completely opposed to it. And he talks about that there are these three trends that are absolutely so bad that they're going to threaten the future of the United States and the world. I mean, this is, you know, what are those three? Like Cassandra, Chicken Little. But they're out there. First one is oil and competition for oil and what it drives us to in terms of wars, trying to dominate other regions. We see the failure of that in Bushco's Iraq policy. And let's not even deal. And one of the other one is the ability of the far right wing, the far Christian right to enforce its social policies on the rest of us. But the other one is what he calls the astonishing levels of debt, current and prospective, that both the government and the American people have heedlessly accumulated. So this debt that Bushco has taken on for the government because he wanted to spend these hundreds of billions on the Iraq war, because this is an investment for the oil company and what they see, oil companies and what they see as the future of the United States, always invested in fossil fuels. So that's partially. So this is, you know, the fact that we're spending a couple hundred billion, they see is going to pay off. Not going to pay off for us so much, but it pay off for his oil buddies. And also, of course, that they keep taking our money and spending it on these big work contractors. And so they get paid off. We don't get this back in services from the government. That's what taxes should be, right? You know what taxes are supposed to be for. Man, this is ain't good. All right. This private debt that is accumulated. So when there was no need, remember, there's no need. Bush came in with a surplus. Now we're a debtor nation, and we're depending on these foreign banks to keep loaning us money. They jacked up the debt ceiling to $9 trillion. I mean, even the conservatives and Republicans are starting to waffle a little on this. Whoa, man, this is going to get out of hand. Because you got to remember what's going to happen is they're going to hand this off to the Democrats like in 2008. Things are going to absolutely be screwed. The war in Iraq is going to be even worse. There'll be tons more losses. The United States will probably have to get out of Iraq like it did in Vietnam with its tail between its legs in an ignominious defeat led by these arrogant and incompetent rulers. Then things will go more to hell. And the Democrats will either be forced to do what the Republicans wanted, was to, you know, stop all social spending and to transfer all this wealth from us to their rich buddies, there won't be in a sense won't be any choice. So they're probably laughing up their sleeves. And what are we doing? Here is Chris in Grand Blanc. Chris, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Well, thank you, sir.
I'm calling in regards to these public service ads I keep on seeing, and I don't just see them on my cable company, which I know provides free airtime for the Partnership for Drug-Free America, but the little jingles they have are nursery rhymes, and they're inciting my child and our children to sing along the ABCs of drugs. All right.
Well, wait. Let me just correct you on one thing. Yeah. Those are not public service announcements. Those are paid advertising. You and I are financing
these insane
things. Yeah.
And they're putting them over GoArmy.com commercials because I'll monitor off-air, satellite, as well as cable channels all at the same time.
Yeah.
And my cable company, and I'd love to say their name, it's 1-800-THEIR-NAME. You can call them if you don't like what they're doing, because I don't. They lie to us repeatedly. Now, we pay for these ads, and they sell us these TVs that have V-chips in them.
Yeah.
Only my V-chip won't block out this objectionable material.
Well, I think, they've shown that those ads are extraordinarily unsuccessful, and if anything, keep raising the idea of drugs and drugs being available and drug usage, like the DARE program, which is this total disaster, which again keeps, it's financed with millions of dollars and doesn't do any good whatsoever, and probably educates more kids about the existence of drugs and new drugs than it does to deter anybody. I mean, people are deterred from taking, using drugs at all, and certainly abusing drugs not by the official finger wagging. I mean, everybody knows that, every kid knows, every teenager, every college student, every young person knows that the big three, parents, police, and principals, and priests, I guess it's four, don't want you to do drugs. And just like if you're, they don't want you to drink when you're, and I'm not saying that that's bad. I mean, I don't, a lot of that stuff doesn't mix with trying to mature and learn and what have you, particularly abuse. I mean, that's really bad. But all it does, I think I've mentioned this before. I mean, I've talked to people, recovering drug addicts, who have said every time they see an anti-drug addict, they said, makes them want to use. They said, this is your brain on drugs. And they show a fried egg. And I said, yeah, that's why I'm doing it. All right, Chris, thanks a lot. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go out to Clarkston and talk to Gary. Hi, Gary. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Let me see. I didn't hit it right, I guess. There you go. Yeah. Sorry, Gary. My fault. You go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, love your show. I've been listening for years. For some caller.
Welcome.
I just want to call comment on a couple things. First off, on World War II, I think actually the United States was a winner as opposed to a loser. I think we helped the Soviet Union as far as supplying goods and supplies.
Oh, yeah.
And
That was what, in a lot of ways, turned the tide. The productive mechanism of the United States, what was called Lend-Lease, which were both to Britain and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, I don't know if they would have had the same capacity to fight the Nazis had they not been for this shipment of goods. But the Soviet Union had been begging the Allies to begin an invasion of Europe beginning in 1942, and the Allies had no interest in it whatsoever. They were completely satisfied to let the Nazis and the Communists go at one another.
Well, I kind of think the United States at the time was basically a country that we just didn't intervene, unlike today. I'm kind of a different. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I think Bush has kind of ruined things, even though I voted for him twice.
well, that'll teach you.
Yeah, but on the same token, too, I disagree with the Democrats as far as the big social programs and different things like that. But I think really, what this comes to is basically. The United States, we need oil. You can say what you want about it. It's good, wrong, bad. You know, people are dying for oil. That's horrible.
Yeah, but
realistically, we need it.
Well, we only need it if we continue. I mean, Bush was the one that said we're addicted to oil and we've got to break it. And, of course, he has, that was just total BS, like most of what he says. But we need oil. In the manner that you do, if we are not imaginative enough to get off of it, because if we keep if we have that as the center of what is fueling our economy, it means we're going to be involved in this stuff forever until we wind up coming up against like China or something like that. Because as these other countries begin to develop their industrial facilities and need oil more and more, and it gets scarcer and scarcer, and we hit peak production, and other small countries, everybody from Saudi Arabia to Venezuela, start figuring, well, maybe I'm going to sell it to the Chinese instead of you. It's a guarantee that that we're going to be into bad times. The other thing to do would be to go on massive programs of alternative fuels and conservation for openers, to think, what could we do so we don't need as much oil, so we don't have to fight wars in the Middle East, so we don't have to have a potential conflict with China. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's go on to Mike. Hey, Mike. Mike's in Monroe, the home of Fermi II and General George Custer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Except I'm 100 yards from Toledo.
No.
Chrysler just made a big deal with Toledo, new mayor. Got to pay, you know, got to do the politics.
Sure, Mike, can you turn your radio completely off?
Yep.
Yeah, because...
got to...
There you go. Go ahead.
Got to play all the politics. Cardi sure. just got re...
That what?
Cardi Finkbinder just got reelected. Got to play the politics. I've been a union carpenter for almost 20 years, but where's the jobs?
Yeah.
Where are they going?
Where are they going?
And everybody wants to beat you up and then stand on your side, and I don't want to do either. I don't want to beat you up. I don't want to stand on your side. I want to say, hey, where are we going? Look at Michigan. Look at Ohio. Look at Almanac. Everybody graduated high school that calls your show?
Yeah.
Let them look at an almanac.
What do you mean an almanac?
I mean, look at the numbers.
Yeah.
Where are we going?
I don't
know. Ohio's going down.
Well, you know what?
Michigan's going down.
You know what, Mike? I think that is the real question that everyone asks. What the hell is going on? I mean, where is the direction for this country and this culture?
I just got turned down for a $14 an hour job because I was making $30 an hour on my last job.
How does that work?
Because I didn't lie on my resume.
Uh huh.
You got to lie on your resume to get a good job. You got to lie on your resume to get a poor job.
Well, things aren't going the way they should, and at some point, I am confident we're going to figure it out. But we're going to be taking a lot of losses. I mean, Daryl, our first caller, just talking about, boom, he's got a job one day, and next day we're closing down. It's terrible. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for joining us. Here's Nigel in Heartland. Hey, Nigel, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to get your opinion on, it's kind of like a radical idea, but in the past year, everybody I know has been coming around to it.
What's that?
That within like 20 to 50 years tops, like we're going to end up in like some big civil war, like revolution thing, because our country is only 200 years old.
Yeah.
You're like, that's why it's so great. But when you look at France and Great Britain, like, of course they've had hard times, but it's like everybody in this country keeps ignoring that. And things keep building up, and pretty soon everything's got to boil over the edge.
Well, who's going to be fighting who, though? I mean, that civil wars usually are between different groups, like the civil war that's going on in Iraq now, or we fought here in this country between the North and the South. I don't know. I mean, there's a difference, too, between a revolution. Now, I mean, that's when all the people get together and say, hey, we're going to turn things over. We're going to change things 100%.
What I kind of mean here is because
We
all have our, like, every issue has two sides, of course.
Yeah, a right side and a wrong side, but go ahead.
Yeah, at the same time, now we all have to fight the government because the government isn't stepping in anymore. They're all off, like, for the war, like, we're all against the war. But then we still have all the issues at home that we're debating about.
Well, that's good, though. And I think that, that kind of debate is healthy. I mean, there are people that want to end debate. They don't think that we ought to have the right to question the government or question policy or anything like that. Those are the dangerous people. The idea that there's a full discussion of everything is excellent. All right, I got to go, so thank you very much. I'll be right back after these. Just again, from V for Vendetta. I haven't seen it. How many of you have? And most people I've seen it said it's pretty good. It looked a little like The Mask of Zorro, though, even with the character and with that mask. But I love the quote from it. People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. Let's make it so.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Into beer, rain, and to burn the crowd that has a name. And to right or wrong, and to meek or strong, it is known to scream from the wall.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. And hey, this is our second hour. So we've got one more hour of taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. We have a couple of exciting interviews at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. I give you the time zone because people are listening all over the world. And if I had a memory, I'd actually remember who my guests are. But they're exciting. One of them I remember is about the Iraq War, the anniversary. And who the hell is the other one? This will come to me. I don't know if I... Well, yeah, we were talking about V for Vendetta tops the box office. Thanks to Julie, who is listening in San Francisco, for sending me this. Came in number one, and it's about a story of revolution against the totalitarian British government. That's cool. And let's see. Oh, yeah, this is interesting, too. I have to, first, but I have to get permission from the person who is in the studio with me. Can I mention your first name?
Sure.
Sure. Well, Shannon is here, and so this is for you. This is for you. She's a colleague. And if I can make this open, by the way, you can keep calling at 313-298-WRIF. So if there's any job problem, Shannon, here you go. This is from Robert. He sent this into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It seems the U.S. military is getting more and more desperate to find volunteers to fight in their bloody quagmire called Iraq. They just announced this week to allow recruits to have tattoos. So you're okay. Pretty soon they'll go after the openly gay prisoners, the elderly, and people who have no health insurance. And I was quoting V for Vendetta. I've done it a number of times. People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. And for 75, 80 years, the Mexican people have been afraid of their governments, this corrupt, brutal, repressive party of institutional revolution or something, which was the opposite. But now there's a party of democratic revolution, and Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador is probably going to be the next president. He says, and I like this quote as well, you can't have a rich government and an impoverished people. I mean, you do. You have that in Mexico, and you have it here. These guys are all multimillionaires as our fortunes continue to sink. All right, let's take another call, and here's Will in Windsor. Will, hi, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for making our show international. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I guess I just wanted to congratulate you on sticking to your guns the last few years with respect to foreign policy in Iraq. It seems that the left was right and the right was wrong.
The right's always wrong. They're wrong about absolutely everything. I mean, they've always... You remember, I asked that a few shows ago. When has the right wing, the conservatives, ever been right about anything?
Well,
they have been on the wrong side of every social question since the beginning of this country when they backed the British. They were for slavery. They were against women voting. They were for every war. They were what? They were against feminism and the women's rights, gay rights, everything. They were against civil rights for African American people. I challenge people. Name one time when the right wing or the conservatives were on the correct side of things. N-O, never.
I agree with you. You're absolutely right. However, if I could just bring up one
sure.
subject. It's a bit off topic, but it's the current Iran controversy that's been bubbling up the last month or so. Just one point I wanted to make is how the argument is being framed. Like last month, if anybody remembers, Dick Cheney publicly, or maybe 3 weeks ago, publicly said that Iran will not be allowed to have nuclear weapons. So they sent out Dick Cheney as a front man to sort of reinforce American stoicism as far as their foreign policy.
But wait a minute. I don't want to be too, well, let's not be too critical of the vice president. He has not shot anyone. He has not shot anyone in
right.
at least a month.
You're right. I'm sorry.
So give the guy a break.
You're right. But I guess the point I wanted to make was, is that for me, looking at it, it's shades of 2000, the summer of 2002 all over again. Like, I know there are problems as far as Iraq, and maybe, you know, it might be a bit of bluff on the Bush administration's, as far as this threat to Iraq goes. But one thing that bothers me is this. Nobody here likes the Iraq regime, especially in Canada, because we had one of our journalists basically killed by the Iranian Secret Service last year. So nobody's they're not popular with us as
no.
they are, as well as they're not with you. But my point is this, is that as far as Iran's pursuit of nuclear energy, they are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Right.
And under that treaty, by law, they have a right to pursue peaceful nuclear energy. Now, when I hear the frame, I hear it in the media, and I'm listening, and we get the American media here, it's being framed as an either-or proposition. Like, Iran, it's either they want nuclear weapons, and that's all there is to it, and we can't let them have it. But that's really not what they're saying, because under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they are allowed, they have said they will allow open inspections.
Right. On the other hand, India, who Bush just went and embraced, is essentially a nuclear outlaw who refuses to sign the non-proliferation treaty and is still going to keep these military facilities, nuclear facilities, off of, they're not going to allow those to be inspected.
Yes.
So I don't get it. And they are capable, of course, of triggering a war with Pakistan. There was already an almost nuclear standoff between the two of them. So it doesn't make any sense. I mean, same thing. North Korea has nuclear weapons, and we say to them, hey, buddy, can we make a deal? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, we got to move on. Thanks again for making the show international. And let's see. Okay, here we go to Rick. It is in Algonac. Hey, Rick, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
A couple comments regarding... Actually, my brother was in the Iraq War, and it's funny what you hear in the media is not what takes place out there. It's funny, we are the superpower, but for some reason they don't want you to know about it. Anyway, I'm going to switch over to a different subject.
Sure.
You mentioned earlier the government is afraid of the people, and I believe that...
No. I said that was from the movie, V for Vendetta, the guy that's fighting the fascist government said that people should not be afraid of their governments. The government should be afraid of their people. This one is not afraid of us at all.
Well, it should be that way because
right.
the people are the voters, and it is for the people, and, you know, we are the people, but there's not enough people standing up. And my subject, what I want to get on is bank fees. And,
bank fees.
Bank fees. This is a small area of, how we're being taken advantage of. Bank fees are outrageous. And
they are.
Is there some way that we can direct people to petition, to charge fees ourselves for example, when the ATMs are unable to dispense money?
Well, that'd be a good idea. Let me tell you something. The worst thing you can do, of course, is bounce a check because it's bad for your credit. And they charge you an arm and a leg. I don't even know what it is. I think the last time I bounced a check was so long ago, it was about $15. I don't know what it is now. I think it's 25 or something more, Shannon's telling me. 30? $30. They love it.
Ask me why.
They love it. They love the fact that you bounce checks because they make tens of millions of dollars a year. Now, last time I bounced a check, which I say was quite a while ago, I called him and I said, I don't get this. This is not a fee. It's a penalty. And I never signed on to allow you to exact a penalty for me. And they said, well, we have data entering fees. I said, what could that be? Like 90 cents? Let's make it $5. And they actually, and I started like really raising the roof. And they said, okay, we're going to reverse it all. We won't. And I mean, I had bounced about five or six checks. It was, $100 or something like that when that was a lot of money to me. And even maybe at the time. But you know what I'm saying? They actually profit greatly from you overdrawing your account. So can we do anything about it? It's like 100 things about job laws, about war. It's about everything that confronts us is that we, the people, are like the afterthought for the elites. How are we going to turn it around? We should talk about that one. Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. Here is Matthew and Taylor. Matthew, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good.
I just like to agree with you on the DARE thing. I believe that's a very pointless program throughout the school systems. I'm not very old, and I believe that program didn't affect me for the better at all. I believe it actually was approached wrong. And, I mean, it's shown in such a sixth grade is when I
really?
Went through the DARE program.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, a lot of the stuff they talked about, I didn't have any clue about it yet already, So, like, it was like they were informing me about things that were out there that I yet didn't know about.
Well, one of the things they want to do, they don't want to be unhip, so they don't want to, like, say, marijuana is rolled into roofers or something. So they want to be very hip, so they know about every brand new drug. And I was looking at this DARE drug. I'm not exactly in the drug subculture. So I'm looking at this stuff, and I've never heard of a third of it. And so, but they're going out there in these, in these, to these kids, like sixth graders, like you're saying, like yourself at the time, and saying, you know, this drug and that drug, and they're going like, whoa, you know. I think it's a drug information system, essentially.
Right. And I just have one more thing to say.
Sure.
One of your callers was talking about a civil war. I've heard before that if we did happen to go into being a civil war, our country would become into a police state. How far off do you actually think that is from happening? Because, I mean, I was in Virginia a couple years ago, and I was on a tour around a naval base, and we had the little cruiser boats, I don't know what they're called, but they had 50 millimeter guns on top of them, and they had them, like, they had the guns pointed right at the tourist boat and everything, you know. I mean, I kind of, it's maybe understandable.
Well, let me just say this. Let's make sure that we're at least being precise in our language. A civil war is when sections of a nation fight one another. Sometimes it's like sections are trying to secede, like in the U.S. South, or it's happened sometimes in Africa, places like that. A revolution is when people rise up and want to overthrow the government or change it drastically. Repression or a fascist state is when the government refuses to allow what we take for granted as our democratic rights. And that's what we're all concerned about, because it's clear that with the torture, with the eavesdropping, with no trials, permanent with imprisonment, with no trial, that this is an administration that has no respect for constitutional guarantees whatsoever. Bush, four times, he hasn't said it lately, but like 2001, 2002, said his favorite form of government is a dictatorship. And he was laughing, you know, like it was a joke, meaning that it's easiest to make decisions when you only have one man. But I think he was serious. Is this going to happen? I don't know. I mean, we're so passive as a people. No matter what we're done, we're robbed. You know, the amount of money we make is robbed from us and given to the wealthy. Wars that nobody support continue on. Civil liberties shred, and we just go, well, we don't like that. So I mean, there's no reason for them to become real repressive. If we really started, making a fuss, well, governments tend to be like that. So we shall see. Thank you. Hey, I wanted to tell you about this. This high school teacher, a drama teacher in Columbia, Missouri. Oh, man, this is a central Missouri high school. I didn't even look where it was. Columbia, Missouri, that's where the University of Missouri is. So it's a sophisticated town. But her spring play was canceled after complaints from these right-wing Christians. She was putting on Grease, and they all went crazy because they show kids smoking and kissing. So now she put on The Crucible. She was going to. Where's her name in here? Wendy DeVore. And her students were to perform Arthur Miller's The Crucible, a drama set during the 17th century Salem witch trials. But they told her she couldn't do it, so she's quitting. So one of the things I just wanted to do, whenever I hear this, and I haven't done this in a while. In fact, I don't think that there's been too much kind of book burning or book banning lately, so I haven't done this. But I always used to do this on my shows, is that whenever I hear about a book that conservatives or these right-wing Christians are trying to suppress, and it's always right-wing Christians and it's always conservatives that are trying to tell you can't read this or you can't see that, right? So The Crucible by Arthur Miller is an extraordinarily strong classic play. And he wrote it in the 1950s when the government was being very repressive in this country. There was this horrible right-wing conservative senator named Joseph McCarthy who was trying to accuse everyone of being a communist. And if you said you were for civil rights, you were a communist. If you wanted to form a labor union, you were a communist. And he made most of this stuff up. In fact, that's what the George Clooney film Good Night and Good Luck is all about. Yeah, right. Go see that. And The Crucible was really talking about that. It's about the witch trials and what they called the Red Hunt or the Red Scare, because there never was any internal threat from communism in this country whatsoever. It was all totally fabricated by these right-wing conservatives to put across their war agenda, put across their internal repression, and to stop things like civil rights and labor militancy. All right, let's go to Dennis. Dennis is in St. Clair Shores. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
How you doing, Pete?
Doing great.
Good. I'm glad you're still there.
Yeah, me too.
Hey, speaking of totalitarian states, I'd wondered if you had heard anything about a speech given by former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
I did indeed.
I don't know too much about it, but I understood that she expressed some concern about the whole country sliding into
a dictatorship.
Yes.
Here is a conservative, an old-fashioned conservative. Let's call her a moderate.
I guess she was a Reagan appointee.
She was a Reagan appointee. She was a Supreme Court justice. She just retired. She gave a speech in the United States talking about that the right wing was eroding the Constitution by its attempt its criticism of the judiciary and its packing the courts, and said that this balance of power is getting out of out of whack. So where did we hear this? Did we hear this on the nightly news? Did we hear it? No. You read it in The Guardian from England, from London.
Okay.
Yeah. That's how bad American media is.
And I guess she must have had a front row seat when the decision was made in 2000 to stop the counting in Florida.
Yeah, she voted for it.
She voted for it.
Yeah. She was one of the five Bush's daddy's pals. Right? He was vice president when the dad was, when she was appointed. So they're just paying off the debt. So, but even suddenly she's turned and become, this critic of what's going on. All right, David, thank you. Appreciate that. Where are we going next? Over to Wes Bloomfield and Rick. Hey, Rick, you're on WRIF. Go ahead. And turn that radio down.
He was vice president when
these guys just don't get it. Put it, Brandon, tell him what the deal is, will you please? All right, thank you. Here is Gus in Monroe again. Fermi II and General George Custer. Are you with me? Gus.
I'm person.
What? Aren't you Gus?
Yeah, Gus in Monroe.
Gus, you're here. You're with us. Go, dude.
Well, if Bush is wrong with what he's doing,
yeah,
where do we go?
I don't know. We're kind of screwed, aren't we?
I don't think so.
No?
No, because we're sitting here, we're looking at the Congress right now, we're looking at 2006, we're looking at prospective congressional changes.
Yeah.
Senate changes.
Yeah.
We as a people, as we're supposed to do, according to 1789, is vote those people in.
Or out, as the case could be, maybe.
Or out. But do you want the same reforms in schools that we have in Michigan right now?
I don't know what those are. What are those?
Well, my wife's a teacher.
Really?
That's a whole nother subject.
Yeah.
But they're not good.
No. What's wrong here? We got an educational system that sucks?
No, we can put any school that is state-funded can have people on the campus recruiting those students for war.
Oh, I mean, they can allow recruiters. Actually, there's a group that are opposing that called FAME. And
I know exactly what they're about.
Yeah, and I can't remember what FAME stands for. I'm going to have that on my website soon. So, I mean, it's an anti-recruiting thing. All right, Gus, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Hey, some open lines suddenly, several of them. And you can grab them. 313-298-WRIF. And here's Dave in Trenton. Dave, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing great.
Great show. I like
Thank you.
To you all the time. I have to take kind of a shot at the economy here, and I have a lot of concern. I've grown up in Wayne County here in the Trenton area pretty much my whole life. And, over that time, Wayne County and Michigan as a whole has been funneled down, you know, has been going down so fast. I mean, it's like we can't keep up. A lot of my friends and family, they've moved from the area. They've gone to and flourished in Florida and California and Las Vegas and lots of different places. And like I was telling the guy when I first called, is I believe that the implosion of Detroit is what really started to bring down the rest of this area. Detroit, in my opinion, and I'm a Democrat, mm-hmm. but all I've seen in Detroit, which is in Wayne County, which is a which is pretty much Democrat as a whole, like 80% or something, is you know, I've seen a lot of corruption. I've seen a lot of these leaders that have led Detroit, and I understand that, you know, I don't know how you feel really about, like, Coleman Young going on to Detroit, you know, even in his scandals of buying gold in South Africa with city money back
in
the day.
You know, those didn't have much to do with what happened to Detroit. Detroit began to deteriorate as its industrial base really began to deteriorate, like, 50 years ago. And there's no one that seriously says that Coleman Young's policies had anything to do with what happened to Detroit. The fact that you have mayors in that were corrupt. Hey, there was a guy, which one was it? Mariani, maybe some guy back in the 50s? Or, I mean, he got sent to federal prison. And there was a guy in the 30s that that got recalled because of corruption. So when you're talking about somebody that's like buying his wife a Lincoln Navigator, that doesn't have anything to do with policy. So, I mean, it's this white suburban myth that somehow that Coleman Young sent the Detroit spiraling down, that everything was wonderful in the city up until 1973, and then it went to hell. You have these large social and economic forces that in many ways aren't even controllable.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, what's mind-boggling to me is, I mean, thank God, I have a good job, and I probably won't lose my job. I mean,
I'm glad you say probably, my friend.
I mean, you never know. I mean, I work for Medtronic, and you know, I'm in pharmaceuticals and whatnot. But I mean, I look at all these people on here, and it's like no one wants to come to Michigan anymore, to this area in particular. And you know, if you look down my street, I mean, if you know anything about Trenton, you know, it's a decent little community in Wayne County, and there's houses in foreclosure. The guy down the street from me, I mean, I own like a $1,600 square foot ranch, and I'm looking at this the other day, and I'm paying $5,000 a year in taxes here on this home alone, and no one wants to come into these houses and buy them from anybody. I mean, it's like, what are we going to do with this economy here? Wayne County.
I have no idea, and in fact, I'm not even sure that it's solvable, because there is this sort of capitalist wheel of misfortune that points fortune and misfortune. So that 50 years ago, the South was this backwater of low wages, and I mean, still is to a large extent. Wasn't highly developed. There wasn't a lot of industry. And now, wow, here's Kia coming over from South Korea. And where are they going to go? Are they going to go in Michigan? No, they're going to go down on the Georgia Alabama border and build facilities worth $1 billion. And that's where the jobs are going to go. So, I don't know. I sure don't have any fast answers, but I thank you for bringing it up. Let's see. Here is Troy in Lexington. Troy, hi. It's Peter Werby on WRIF, and so are you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How's it going? First of all, I just want to say I listen to your show, and I think it's very educational.
No, thanks.
And I'm calling to talk about it's kind of off the subject, but
that's all right.
About never-ending battle trying to get ahead. You know, I was working in a factory, and I was only bringing home about $300-$400 a week, trying to live off that and raise my family. And you know, I got to the highest I can go in the factory, and all I got every year was a cost of living raise. Well, you know, and then every year they'd raise your health premiums up, so I was actually losing money every year.
Yeah, I hear you. That's not unusual.
And then, so I made the choice to switch careers and go to truck driving and be gone all the time. And I'm making twice the money as what I was before. But, yeah, I'm still struggling to get by, because now with the price of gas going up, the price of, you know, natural gas to heat my house,
yeah,
car insurance, everything's gone up. It's just like, you know, I'm no further ahead than I was before, making twice the money.
Well,
it's crazy.
It is crazy, and it's sort of a way in which the people running things, they look and they see, well, is there any organized resistance? And since we don't show it, and I'm not being critical of you, Troy, at all. I'm sure you've got enough to do, doing your job and raising your family and trying your damnedest and working as hard as you can. And yet, I mean, if you think about other periods in history, like when the unions formed in the 1930s, I mean, this roused whole communities to confront the employers who, of course, then were ripping people off big time, like they usually try to do. And yet then we had some, you know, our fathers and grandfathers had some way to which they could fight back. But right now, there's not an organized way that we can confront this, so they just keep taking more and more and more and more. But they're so greedy that I think at some point there's going to be an explosion of sorts.
Yep, exactly. I mean, I penny pinch every little thing I get. Like, I buy gallons of Kool-Aid to drink now instead of pop. You know, just the price of a 20-ounce bottle of pop can cost you anywhere from $1.30 to $1.50.
Well, here's the only advice I'm going to give you tonight, Troy. Swear off both of them. For you and the family, you'll all be better off. All right, thanks for adding your story. I really appreciate it. Here's Gary in Lansing. Gary, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi there. As a college student going to LCC right now, is with Michigan's unemployment rate, my family's lived in Michigan as far back as I can remember. Is there, like, as far as job opportunities go, are there any in Michigan, and like, is there any going to be any big boom? Because I know as soon as Detroit had their, you know, the collapse of the auto business, there's nothing left in this state. Everything's just gone way downhill, and you know, I'm frustrated at the point of, you know, where am I going to be at in 5 years? I'm going to have to move out of this state just to get a job. You know, I like this state; it's a good state, but without a job, it's nothing.
Well, I know what you mean, and that's what, when you start getting these conservatives who start talking about the free market, and they say, well, if the jobs are elsewhere, you should go somewhere else. So what that means, essentially, is that you have to give up this history of one's family in Michigan, and you know, people did that. A lot of our ancestors came from Europe because of economic reasons. I mean, there are a lot of other reasons, but that's one of them. But again, it's like we're chips of wood and afterthoughts to the big forces that control the society. And right now, we don't have much options because we all confront these large economic and social trends as individuals, and we're not strong enough as a single person to confront that. So until there is, like I keep saying, organized resistance, and people say, well, good, I can't pay any rent with that, I can't make my house payment with that, I can't get a job with that, with some promise that some guy on the radio is talking about organized resistance and he doesn't even know what form it's going to take. Well, at a juncture like this, this is the best I can do, but we all better start thinking about it. That's what I would have to say. All right, thanks, Gary, appreciate it. Let's see, we can take another call right now. Let's go over to what we used to call the mistake by the lake, Cleveland, although now it's a pretty cool city, isn't it, Jim? Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a couple things I'd like to talk about. I really am concerned. You know, you talk about resistance, formal resistance, and there is a lot of people that are upset in the United States. And we've become so involved with, just like the past callers, struggling to survive, that what they've done is they've taken the United out of United States.
Uh-huh.
And it's just the States of America, more or less. And I think what we have to do is start at a social level before we get to a revolution, because it could possibly go that way. We have to contact our representatives. And the first thing that people have to understand is we're selling off our infrastructure here in the United States. We're selling off our roads, our railways.
Our ports.
Our ports. you know, and it's sad that people get upset, but they don't make that one phone call to a congressman and a senator and let them know. Pass legislation not allowing foreign countries to purchase our infrastructure.
Now, that is happening. But I got to tell you, Jim, and calling your senator representative is okay, particularly if you got somebody like Dennis Kucinich, like you may, down there. But when I thought you were saying about the social level, what that means is we have to stop functioning as individuals and start finding ways that we can confront this collectively, because ultimately that's the way it's impacting us. I mean, we can say, well, I've lost my job, or I can't find a job, or my health care has come up. But there's tens of millions of us that are similarly situated, and as long as we act as individuals and not with the power of those millions, we're going to keep just having to take whatever we get. And it seems to be getting worse and worse. All right, I got to go to a break. Jim, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Hey, thanks a lot, and welcome back to our final segment at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. We'll have a couple of interesting interviews for you. If I had a memory, I would actually be able to announce it. Do I have my website up? It's actually on my website. That's a good way for me to check it out. You can, too. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. All right, here is Tim in Detroit. Tim, hi, it's Peter Werbe.
How you doing, Pete? Yeah, before I wanted to go into my main topic tonight, I wanted to talk about the DP World deal. Apparently, Carlisle's going to get it.
Tim said it kind of quickly, it's the Carlisle Group.
Uh-huh.
And Carlisle is Bush's father's firm that makes all these among other things. I mean, it's kind of the beginning of what I call international general, right?
I know. It's all you play the rollerball. It's like that movie that came out years ago. But anyway, I wanted to talk about someone named Philip Markowitz.
Sure. Who's that?
He's a Holocaust survivor, and he was interviewed on another station. And he talked about basically when he was captured at Dachau, and later on he was transported to Flossenbürg, another concentration camp. And at the end of the war, effectively the whole camp was trying to kill all the all the Holocaust survivors. And he ended up escaping with his brother. The Nazis ended up opening fire on a lot of the escaping mostly Jews, but other also concentration camp prisoners. His brother and Philip dived into a ditch and effectively faked their own deaths and were rescued by this German farmer who protected them until the Allies came by.
What a story these people had from that generation. I often read obituaries of World War II people like him, or flyers, or people, and I go, man,
he's still alive.
What a life.
Anyway, I mean, one of the hosts was asking him about the state of fascism in the U.S., the possible coming of it, and he said that under his terms, that we're not becoming a fascist state in the sense that Germany became. But then he began to acknowledge that a lot of the civil liberties, civil rights, privacy laws are really becoming eroded, and people should be concerned. So I would say that people should become much more active in this country, because truly this country is becoming non-democratic. It's not just hyperbole.
Yeah, right. I agree. Well, yeah, you don't know what way things are going to go. I mean, for instance, I don't think that out of nowhere could Bush order the military to create a fascist state. I think they would say, we're not doing this because there's not a political class that Bush represents in that coherent a form that is linked with the military the way it is, say, like in Latin America, or the way it was in Germany.
Well, you could put it under the rubric of war on terror. For example, I also understand now that the Department of Homeland Security is building these camps inside the U.S., and the argument is they're supposed to house illegal Chinese immigrants, of all things.
Well, they've had camps forever.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is like a new contract, supposedly, that was either signed last week or the week before that.
Oh, great. That's nice.
I mean, I thought that the cliche would be Mexican immigrants, but supposedly there are all these Chinese immigrants that are between here and China. And the Chinese government doesn't want them back, and the U.S. doesn't know what to do with them, so effectively it's building these camps for whole families.
Well, isn't that sweet? All right, thank you, Tim. I appreciate that information. Huh. Here's who going to my website. We're going to hear from Antonia Juhas, who's written a book called The Bush Agenda, and we're going to talk about the implications of this being the third anniversary of Bush's illegal war based on lies. And also, I like this interview, Elliot Lewis, who wrote Fade, My Journey in Multiracial America. In fact, I start off the interview as I remember talking about, we know that there are black people and white people and Asian people and Hispanic people, right? And everything's real cut and dry. Well, Elliot Lewis says, if you go beyond racist concepts of what race is, that he's mixed race, because he's like, you kind of look at him on his book, and he looks very much so like a combination of somewhat of African ancestry and European ancestry, except in this racist country, if you have any so-called black blood, if you can imagine that in you, you're considered black, no matter how, quote, white you may look. So anyways, he talks about that. He's multiracial and the implications of that. I found it kind of pretty interesting. Oop, I didn't undo that. Oh, I see what's happening. Never mind. Just a little technical glitch, but we got it. Here's Stephen in Oak Park. Stephen, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Just wanted to call with a comment about the recruiting. Some guy called earlier and said, the recruiting in the schools and stuff. And,
right.
For me, I graduated in 96, and I'm sure recruiting stepped up a bit since this whole Iraq deal blew up in our faces. But I know back in 96, there really wasn't that much pressure to be recruited, but for me, that was the only way out of my small hick town.
Of Oak Park?
Oh, no. I was born and raised in Clio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, way, well, not way up there, but definitely farm town. For me, I was accepted to college, but my thought was, okay, well, I don't want to put the burden on my parents. I don't have the money myself, and I don't want to be one of those college kids who, go to school for 8 hours a day and then go work at, wherever for the next
10 hours and get about 4 hours of sleep a day for 5 years. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, it's tough.
So instead of doing that, you know, the Army was the best way out for me, and without the Army, I'd have never got out of here. You know, I'd have never experienced everything I've experienced, and I wouldn't have got the job that I have now.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, I mean, the recruiters, you know, like I said, I mean, I'm sure they're pushed up the recruiting efforts a wee bit, you know, well, not even a wee bit, probably a good bit, you know, trying to get more people for this war. But, you know, there are other jobs in the Army and other branches of the military than just your standard ground pounder.
Yeah, I don't know why people wouldn't join, like, the Air Force, because I just talked to a neighborhood kid and who told me he's joining the Army. I said, don't you know there's a war going on? And he said, oh, I forgot what he's, med tech or something like that. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing. And I said, well, what about Iraq? He says, oh, it'll be over by the time I'm, time I'm ready to go. And I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, how about, like, Vietnam, which went on forever? And also, right. You can be a med tech or you can be anything under the sun, and you're saying, okay, you got to go to this town, and they're going to put you in an unarmored Humvee, right?
Yep.
So there is always that risk. I guess I have to say, I don't think this would be a very smart time to join the military. All right, Stephen, thank you. I appreciate it. Here is Bill in Southfield. Bill, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Peter. I wanted to get your comments about one of these ultra-conservative right-wingers. I was listening to a show the other day, and they were talking about, you know, the war in Iraq and how they can't get enough people to go over there. And the military, their explanation now is that, well, it's not that they can't get enough. They're saying that they got all kinds of people coming in volunteering, but 75% to 80% of them don't measure up to military standards, and that's how they're explaining that away, that they can't get enough people. And I was just wondering if you could, you know, maybe come up and give me your comments, what you think on that.
Well, don't you think they're altering their standards? I thought that they were dropping. They've been doing that for a long time.
Well, they always do during the time of war. They always take people during time of war that they don't normally take in peacetime. But, you know, things are so bad, it just kind of amazes me how they'll twist the facts to suit their way of thinking. And some of these, I don't know, conservatives are just off the wall, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how anyone could sit there and listen to that stuff night after night.
Well, I don't know how people that aren't conservatives can listen to those shows. They drive me absolutely off the wall, something, I don't know. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call, Bill. Thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. Here's somebody who wants to talk about something after my own heart. Mike, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Peter, for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tackle this this issue about the gas prices. I really think they're very pointless, and I was just wanting to get some answers of why they're so expensive.
Well,
is it because of this war that we're fighting, or
no? It's because they can. Because there's not, you know, sometimes other countries, when they start trying to raise the cost, all of a sudden the entire fleet of truck drivers will go on strike and block roads and all that. And suddenly, they say, oh, well, maybe we better reduce the gas prices a little. They figured it out real quickly. I mean, they're gouging us. This whole panel of Midwest governors said, yeah, that they're just they see the opportunity. They use whatever they can as an excuse, and they I mean, in other words, they pump up the price. I mean, the pump at the barrel head is up. Well, I think it even went down, but it was, you know, it's gone up to like $60 a barrel. So it's understandable it would go up, but the prices have gone up more than their cost, because we know they're making record profits, right? So that's called,
right.
That's called gouging.
Right, right.
Hey, you know, there's something, I don't know if you got the spelling of my name, but on my website there is something that Dave wrote into me, and what you do is you enter your zip code in the site, and it tells you which gas stations have the cheapest prices.
Oh, okay.
So if you go to my website, last name's Werbe, you got to go way down. It's not, I know you're not supposed to do that on websites, but I don't know how else to do it. You go down about halfway down through all the war stuff, all the anti-Bush stuff, all that, and then there'll be this whole little section about gas and gas prices. and there's this deal where you can do that. So I put in, I put it in my site and found the cheapest gas.
Okay, well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you for calling and listening. And, I mean, still not cheap. I mean, don't get me wrong, but at least you're not paying the top dollar. Here it, oh, my Lord, Jessica, welcome to the broadcast. You're our first woman today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think women don't like me. They don't. They never call.
Maybe it's just because a lot of guys call up and they don't feel like they're supposed to or something. I don't know.
They're supposed to.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
Yeah. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, first, I want to kind of chide you. You can't say that there's no hope, man.
Oh, I didn't mean to say that.
You can't say that. You know, I know it's an easy impulse to say, you know, oh, we're screwed, but I think that's one of the easiest excuses I've heard for not doing anything is, well, we're screwed. But I, as I like to say, is ideally you're going to live to 80-something. So mm-hmm. you probably have a good 50, 60 years to work on it. That's time to at least make a little bit of change.
Well, here, let me say, when I said that to the person, they said something, and I said, well, I guess we're screwed. I was being somewhat facetious.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Well, what I wanted to say was, what I want to talk about was education. I'm in
sure.
school to be a teacher, and I know that influences, but I think, like the guy who was in the military, you bring your life experience with you. I think we need to work on education. I think that people can't create change if they don't understand what they're talking about. If you start talking about things, if they try and turn on the station where they, you know, the TV stations where they're talking about legislation, or they try and read about the legislation, if they don't understand it, then they can't do anything about it.
You're right.
You know, people get embarrassed and they don't want to do anything about it because they don't know what you're talking about. And I think that our education system, and specifically Michigan, earlier we were talking about Michigan, my younger sister, they've started gearing classes towards the MEEP, even though no one cares about the MEEP. They've started gearing classes towards the MEEP. She had a black and white color spectrum in her science book.
Yeah. Huh.
How are you supposed to, a black and white color spectrum?
Well, that's a little tough. Well, Jessica, I mean, I think you put your finger on it, and the idea that so many of the educational systems in different districts are so poor, and I never understood this. I thought we were supposed to have this big lottery that was supposed to fund all of the education. It's supposed to bring it. Maybe it does, but still, why isn't there enough? I mean, why is this the wealthiest country in the world, and we're talking about things going downhill? Bush says the economy's up, the stock market's over 11,000. And there's problems. Doesn't make a bit of sense. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you. Appreciate it. Here is Ty. Ty's in Novi. Ty, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Love your show. I've only caught it a couple times, but, man, it's so refreshing to hear similar points of view.
Well, thank you.
And what I wanted to say is I just wanted to comment to the gentleman who spoke about the declining numbers of enlistees to the military.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I've noticed is whenever anyone, especially corporations, would like to not show a loss or a decline in numbers, they don't give actual numbers. They'll give percentages so that, you know, you don't know, you don't realize that the number may have declined from 500 to 50 if I just tell you 75% of the enlistees do not meet the standard. You know, that 75% could very well be 40 enlistees, 42 enlistees, when before it may have been as many as 420.
Yeah, well, they actually, the problems they've been having in recruiting are well known, although I haven't heard much about it lately. I don't know whether they've been making their goals or not. You know, Ty, it is just way too noisy on your end, but I appreciate your input, so thank you very much for joining us. Here is, I'm sorry, I don't have the name. Hi, who's this? You're on the air. Hello, hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have your name up on the screen. What?
This is Jeff from Monroe.
Hi, Jeff, you're on the air. What, are you guys all in the same room at Monroe, in Monroe?
No. No, I got something on trash, Canadian trash, I thought you might find interesting.
Sure, wasn't there just something in the news about that? about the trash coming in from...
Yeah, well, we had a big spill up here. We had human feces dumped all over the road, contaminating the area here.
Man, I hate when that happens.
Yeah, what's kind of funny is I spoke with two of the candidates for the state Senate spot that are running down here in Monroe.
Yeah.
One Republican, Randy Richardville, and the other one is Bob Shockman. He is running as a Democrat. They asked them both the same question. I confronted them about the Canadian trash issue, and, you know, I did some research, and I always do that before I talk because I want to see what they're going to say. And I kind of found their answers to be quite puzzling. Mr. Shockman, he blamed everything on Randy Richardville when he was a representative as a Republican, said that Randy Richardville didn't do anything, and he pretty much blamed the Republicans in the, on the state level for not limiting the intake of the trash. He didn't really elaborate a lot, so I kind of felt that he really didn't know.
Wait, wait a minute. I thought that they passed a bill like banning that or something, didn't they?
From what I understand is they're trying to limit they're trying to raise the amount of money and the weight fee is what they're doing. But, you know, that's just going to come back on us because we have to pay. That's how we pay for our trash pickup is by the weight.
Yeah, well, just think about it. We're having trouble with our economy here in Michigan. We could become the trash dump of America. Got to get a couple of last calls in here, so thank you for yours. Let's see, here is Mike. Mike's in St. Clair Shores. Mike, you're on WRIF. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was just curious. I just wanted to see what your opinion is on the Michigan economy over here. You know, everything we pick up, I mean, we got all these factories sitting around. Can't we just pick up and make baseball caps, tennis shoes, whatever?
It'll be like Haiti. You know, we can make baseballs.
I mean, if you got to go and pay $5 more for a pair of tennis, you know what I mean, just to pay the people.
I don't think they don't make any shoes in the United States at all anymore.
No, I mean, the ashtray I can pick up right here says made in China.
Yeah.
Go to a Red Wings game, buy a hat, $25, made in China. There's nothing made here. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, that's what happens when you lose your industrial base. You wind up in that situation. I mean, so this $25 ball cap probably costs, and when you get materials and labor, which ain't much, and shipping, yeah, it probably comes out to about $4 or $6 or something like that, and then there's $19 in profit. So that's a little hard to beat. I mean, that's sort of the problem. I mean, Delphi. The parts manufacturer that's almost going belly up. I mean, their big competition isn't even from like Asia. It's from non-union shops in Ohio. So what it means is that everything starts spiraling downward, what they call the race to the bottom. And it doesn't just drop off like this big precipice. I mean, a lot of people are doing okay. And I'm probably thinking, what the hell are they talking about? Everything's good. You know, I got a new car. I got a great job. But it starts to be a death of 1,000 cuts, and more people are starting to feel it. Here's Daniel in Wayne. Daniel, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I got a comment about Michigan's economy type kind of deal.
Yeah?
I'm going to grow. I'm in college right now. I'm going to be a teacher, actually. And there's been a lot of talk about how there's, like, not too many jobs available right now and how there's supposed to be an upturn or whatever pretty soon.
Uh-huh.
But I've noticed a few things, like, with the economy. It's like everybody's got new cars. You know, we've all got good jobs. I just got promoted, you know, trying to make my way through college. And I think a lot of people are exaggerating how bad the economy is right now.
Well,
I mean,
you know, during the Depression, the majority of people were working. And, I mean, you think when you hear these stories that you've heard on this show, you think people are exaggerating? I mean, this is exactly what I'm talking about. If you as an individual are doing okay or better than you did previously or think that your future is so bright you got to wear shades, doesn't mean that it's true for everyone. I mean, I was reading these figures earlier, unless you think these government agencies are making them up, is that, in fact, there's been an average decrease in the totality of the wage. So if you triple your wage between 2001 and 2004, that doesn't mean anything. We're talking about how does it ultimately have an impact on the entire economy. So you can't just look from your own private situation. Here is Nick in Saginaw. Nick, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Good. Hey, I'm actually a reservist activated down in Fort Benning, Georgia right now as a drill sergeant. You guys were talking about the standards for enlistees and stuff coming in, and I can tell you as a drill sergeant, the standards haven't been lowered at all. If anything, they've been increased a little bit because we understand that although recruiting's down a little bit, they're picking from the bottom of the barrel, they still got to meet the same standards when they go to combat. So
Well, no, what they're talking about, I mean, the Pentagon announced that they were, like, on the intelligence tests and aptitude tests, they were lowering the standards for that.
Oh, to get them in. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, though. Yeah, we're seeing some of the bottom of the barrel, but when they leave basic training, I can tell you they're ready to go.
Yikes, the bottom of the barrel. All right, I got to move on quickly. I want to get my last call right here. Mike, hi, give us a quick one. Thanks for calling in from Temperance.
Quick one. Southern Monroe County.
Yeah?
Northern Lucas County.
Yeah.
The economy's.
Hey, Mike.
Don't stand up.
Were you on the show earlier?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Go ahead. Give me your final thought, though, so I can.
I want to know your thoughts about the economy in Southern Monroe County.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to do that another night. In fact, I have no idea what's happening in those counties per se, but we can perhaps another day. Get it on. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Stay tuned for the interviews. I think you'll enjoy them. We'll talk next week.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah.
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tune for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Why drink the water from my hand? Contagious as you think I am. Just took my son towards your domain. You can't run it over again.
On WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. You're listening to this on Sunday, and Saturday and Sunday, there were anti-war demonstrations all over the world on the anniversary of year three of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and I thought we'd take a look back and see what's been accomplished, how this all started, where we're at now, and what the future portends. Joining me once again is Antonio Yuhas, and Antonio Yuhas is the author of an upcoming book that, in fact, was upcoming last time we talked with her. But, you know, I don't think it's delayed. It's called The the Bush agenda, invading the world one economy at a time. In fact, you can go to the bushagenda.net. It'll also be on my website, peterwerby.com. And also, Antonia Juhas is a visiting scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you very much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me again. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it is, what do they say, an auspicious occasion on the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. General Pace, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, just said things were going very, very well. He didn't even say very well. He said very, very well. The casual observer, let alone someone who looks at it closely like yourself, you wouldn't think it would on the face of it. Doesn't look like it's going too well.
Well, it depends on which standard you're using, and, you know, who's doing the analysis. I think the generals in the U.S. military have been getting in trouble as of late with the Bush administration for actually speaking their minds and saying, you know, for example, that the presence of the U.S. military is intensifying the insurgency and that U.S. soldiers are under increased insecurity in Iraq, and now we're starting to see a string of statements by the U.S. military that couldn't be rosier when, as you say, anyone who listens to people speaking from Iraq, who looks at images from Iraq, and looks at polls of the U.S. public would say that things couldn't be going worse. Mm-hmm. Both for our soldiers and for the people of Iraq.
Well, there's public goals, and then that the U.S. has, the Bush administration has, and then there's ones that we sort of intuit. Maybe you could speak to both of those. First off, the stated goals and how close or far away they are to that, and also what you believe are the real goals there.
Well, today is an auspicious day, and not only are we looking at the sad moment of the three-year anniversary of the war, but also the president released his new national security strategy, which sets out the administration's vision for its national security agenda, and a great deal of that strategy is devoted to the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what the president says in this document is his latest repeated statements on what the war in Iraq is about, because, of course, that's changed a tremendous amount through the course of the 3 years. But the current stated objective and what victory will look like is an Iraq that has no more violence, that has no more insurgency, that has an elected government that represents the people of Iraq and that is stable. Very difficult goals to meet, even on the face of them.
Well, and I was going to say, ones that I think everyone, from the insurgents to Bush to myself to you, would like to see. The definitions of those and how those are arrived at, I suppose, are the sticking points, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly admirable goals, which we would all like to see. Certainly goals that we are not currently on the path to achieving, however, by the way that the administration is executing this war. And then, you know, as you say, what I think the real agenda is, my book, The Bush Agenda, is on time, and it'll be released April 25th, so that is coming up, and where I go into greater detail. But the shorthand is what I think the administration is on track to achieve in Iraq is what I call its oil timeline for removing itself from Iraq. And that is the agenda for the economic dominance of the country, particularly dominance over the country's oil resources. And as I detail in the book, there is a timeline for gaining particularly control of the oil resources, which most likely won't be really set in motion or securely set in motion until the end of 2006, which is one of the main reasons why the administration will not talk about even beginning to draw down troops until the end of 2006, and rather is at the moment increasing our troop level in Iraq. And that process has been put in place even before the invasion began, which was to restructure Iraq's economy, first of all to allow foreign country access. than to allow private investment.
Wait, let me just back up. Be a little clearer, I should say expand on what you're saying about foreign country access.
Well, so the first thing is in terms of ownership of Iraqi businesses and access to the Iraqi market. Prior to the invasion, only people from Iraq or people from Arab countries could own a business in Iraq or even partner with an Iraqi in a business in Iraq.
This was even in the Constitution, I believe.
Yes, this was written in the Constitution.
Yeah.
That was a measure that was quickly eliminated by the Bush administration, specifically by Paul Bremer, who was the head of the U.S. government of Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority, for about 14 months.
Well, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but
sure.
I mean, this is so crucial because you had a country that in its constitution forbid essentially what's going on all over the world, and that is the looting of other economies by the Western democracies through what they call investment or the penetration of their economies. And to make sure this didn't happen, whatever we want to say about this monstrous dictator, Saddam Hussein, he wanted to make sure that what was produced in terms of wealth in Iraq stayed in Iraq. So the war occurs, an invasion happens, and a single man who goes over there with a suit and work boots on says, this is ended. Now we can have foreign penetration, foreign economic penetration, and investment and profits can be taken out. Is that a decent summary?
Oh, yeah, and it goes even farther than that, and in my mind, even more extreme than that, because one of the many provisions that the United States was committed to as an occupier of Iraq was that it would not change any of Iraq's fundamental legal structures. That was a commitment that the United States has in its own laws. It's in the Army Code's laws for when it is being an occupier, and it's also under the Geneva Conventions, and it's something to which the United States agreed to adhere to under the United Nations agreement to allow the U.S. to occupy Iraq. And the very first thing the United States did was fundamentally transform the entire economic structure. And as you say, you know, whether or not you agree with the economic structure that was in place when the U.S. invaded, it was certainly by no means the U.S. The U.S.'s right or its or even something it was allowed to do to transform that economic structure in a way that the Bush administration chose, which is exactly what happened. And Paul Bremer transformed the economic structure completely unilaterally, as essentially, in the words of the UN special envoy to Iraq, as a new dictator of
mm-hmm.
Iraq. And the economic policies are very broad, but they do things like eliminate tariff and quota restrictions that had existed in Iraq to limit the influx of foreign produced products, and as you said, to protect the Iraqi market. They limited foreign investment rights, the amount of money that could flow from foreign businesses into Iraq, foreign ownership, as I said. The new laws allow for 100% of Iraq's market to be open to foreign private investment. It allows for the privatization of all of Iraq's state-owned enterprises except, and this is a very important caveat, which I'll get back to later, for the exploration of oil. So that excludes the state oil company. It allows for the 100% repatriation of profits, which means that all of the companies that are operating in Iraq, all the U.S. companies that have made literally tens of billions of dollars, the price tag is actually up to almost $50 billion for U.S. companies operating in Iraq, none of them have to invest any of that money in Iraq. All of it can be sent back to the United States. These and many other provisions have, I would argue, busted open the Iraqi market from a legal perspective, making it possible for U.S. corporate extreme access.
Mm-hmm. Antonia Juhas,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm just going to reintroduce you. Antonia Juhas is my guest. She's a visiting scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of the upcoming book, The Bush Agenda. You can check that out at thebushagenda.net. I'm Peter Werby. And yet, in order to accomplish, and when, you know, I know it's pretty complicated, but a shorthand version I usually use is a war for oil to a war for military bases. But the political situation there, particularly when you have this Shiite majority that's seems to be ideologically, religiously aligned towards Iran, are they going to be able to pull this off, even if they can defeat the insurgency?
Well, there's two parts of this. The first is, as you say, what's the new political structure of Iraq going to look like? And I think that the most important standard for the Bush administration, in my mind, that they are looking to decide whether they have successfully implemented a new good government for them, from their perspective in Iraq, is that government more favorable to U.S. interests than the last 10 years of Saddam Hussein's regime, in which the United States was increasingly being shut out of Hussein's movement into a larger global investment framework. So to get more specific in terms of oil, Hussein was signing dozens of oil contracts with foreign countries, particularly in the last few years of his reign. And these were contracts to explore for oil, to sell oil worth billions, trillions of dollars, with companies from France and Germany and China and Russia. There were dozens of countries, actually, that were involved potentially in getting contracts with Hussein. The United States was very specifically not one of those countries, and our companies were being locked out. And this is, of course, a country, Iraq, that has, at a minimum, the second largest oil reserves left in the world, and some people believe could potentially even rival Saudi Arabia's potential oil reserves. So the United States and the Bush administration was increasingly seeing the writing on the wall that if the sanctions were removed and Hussein started signing and moving forward with those oil contracts, the rest of the world was about to get its hands on this incredible bounty. So I would argue this is in the main motivations for the Bush invasion of Iraq. The economic transformation I was telling you has laid the groundwork for the oil invasion, which is next. A new oil law is making its way through the Iraqi government. It's actually, we have heard, completed, but waiting to be implemented for the new government to finally take place, that would open Iraq's oil sector to private foreign investment using the preferred model set out by the State Department, the U.S. State Department, which are production sharing agreements, and opening the door to U.S. to U.S. companies to sign contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the person who it looks like now is most likely to replace Jafari as the Prime Minister of Iraq is a Shiite whose name is Abdel Mahdi, and he was previously the finance minister of Iraq as appointed in the interim government, the most recent government, and then he was a vice president of Iraq, currently is a vice president of Iraq, and is the preferred replacement to Jafari by the most conservative Shiite alliance. Mahdi is someone who has met with both President Bush and Cheney, Vice President Cheney. He has spoken to the American Enterprise Institute of his deep devotion to expanding access to U.S. corporations and particularly U.S. oil corporations in Iraq. He is a secular Shiite and someone who has been a long-term ally since the invasion of the Bush administration. The members of the Iraqi Parliament and likely government are in no way the dream government that a Bush administration, you know, would have fantasized about. But it is the members, the Kurdish members, the Shiite members, and many of the Sunni members, in large part, support the basic necessities, let's put it that way, of the Bush administration's invasion: economic access to the United States access to U.S. oil companies and a continued military presence by the U.S. military, as you said, the bases, and it looks like that may still all come to pass.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Are they going to be able to pull this out? Because obviously the owners of the oil companies, the investors, the whole Bush crew, they're not suffering any direct casualties physically.
Right.
And when we hear that the war has already cost over $200 billion, and people calculate it in terms of that it could pay for almost 2 million affordable housing units or 40 million scholarships for university students or a real health program, and we as taxpayers say we've lost all that. Well, we have, but it's not like it got lost in the laundry or, one of those things like that. Got ruined in the washing machine. That $200 billion moved to very important players in all this. So, and it looks from here, you'd almost think, Jesus, curtains for Bush and everything that they plan. And you're suggesting that maybe with all this carnage, all this wreckage, all this loss of tax revenue, these long-term goals of these neoconservatives is going to triumph.
Well, I hope not. I hope that's not the case. I mean, let me say the ways that things have not worked to the Bush administration's plan. One, they certainly did not anticipate that it would take this long to have things look good from the outside. They did not anticipate, at this point in the game that only 35% of the American public would support the war. Only 37% of the American public would support Bush. Looks like we're probably talking about the same people, that they would be fighting within their own party, and that it would take three long years and more than, and thousands and thousands of American soldiers' lives and soldiers from around the world and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilian lives to secure their political and economic access to this country. However, as you said, they seem hell-bent and willing on letting it continue. And I think the reason is, one, they think they will get enough outward stability in time for the next elections not to do too much harm. Two, the money that is being spent on the war is going to defense contractors, energy companies, oil service companies, allies of the Bush administration. There is a lot of money flowing to allies of the Bush administration. And three, it looks like they're still going to get what they're after in the end, which is, ultimately, whether you want to see it from a positive side or a negative side, I see it very negatively, U.S. access to Iraq's oil that will be guaranteed, and U.S. corporate access to what will become potentially, one of the wealthiest countries in the region, if stability can be achieved. And I think that could still happen if the American public isn't able to turn its antipathy towards the war also towards antipathy towards the entire agenda, and to stop that process from moving forward of turning over essentially the country's economic and political future to Bush administration interests.
Well, right now, Antonio Yuhas, of course, we see more and more tax dollars being spent, more and more casualties, and it's our casualties and our money that I would say probably has turned them, unfortunately, has been the item that has turned most people against the war. I say unfortunately because we should have a sense of American deaths, Iraqi deaths as well as having our tax dollars being spent on destroying and then at least having ostensibly rebuilding Iraq, which we should maybe talk about. However, what about really from a selfish point of view? I know you're probably familiar with the arguments of Professor Michael Clare, who talks about that in a world with decreasing fossil fuel resources and increasing demand, one might make the argument that, hey, we run on fossil fuels, the old break a few eggs to make an omelet, and if this means that we're going to have political and military and fuel hegemony in that region in order to maintain our what do they call it? It's not
living. Standard of living.
Thank you. Yeah. Standard of living, well, maybe it's just going to be worth it.
Well, one of the important things that Professor Clare says is that there are tremendous repercussions from such a desire to maintain our standard of living and pursue wars, engage in wars in pursuit of that standard. And that is the tremendous repercussions in hatred and increasing acts of deadly violence targeted against the United States and its allies because of our actions, particularly in the Middle East, that the presence of U.S. troops in the Middle East, particularly in Saudi Arabia, the support of the United States for some of the worst regimes in the world, the engagement in wars that have killed tens of thousands, if not 100,000 people in Iraq, has turned the most intense level of hatred against the United States that we've witnessed in quite a while, and hatred that is increasingly revealing itself in deadly acts of violence. And if we want that to end, if we don't want to be in this position where, you know, I think many people in the United States are starting to feel that, you know, we do have to let the Bush administration spy on us. We do have to start to limit our civil liberties. We do have to spy on each other when we're riding on the bus or sitting in a cafe, because we are living in an increasingly dangerous world, and people are increasingly willing to let loose our own civil liberties, some of the most important things that make us, you know, a land of the free, as the president likes to say, because of the increased violence. And I think we're going to see more people willing to make that trade-off if we're not able to reduce the acts of terror against the United States and its allies. And the only way to do that will be to stop putting ourselves in a position where we are willing to fight wars to defend our standard of living. And one of the things that Michael Clare says, which I think is very true, is that as the supply of oil, you know, as we reach the peak of world production of oil and we start to decline, the tension between countries seeking those last bits of oil are going to increase, and wars are going to increase. And the only way that we can respond to that in a way that makes sense is not to beef up our military so that we can be the ones fighting most aggressively in those wars, but rather to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. And to really do that in a meaningful way, we are going to have to change our standard of living, but not in ways that are, you know, reprehensible or returning to, you know, a horse and buggy, but rather simply things such as increasing the fuel efficiency of our cars, reducing the size of our cars, increasing our use of public transportation and investments in public transportation, increasing our investments in solar and wind energy. These are all things that don't fundamentally transform our way of life.
Well, some of these conservative commentators think that people like you and me want to take away their 18-cylinder, 900-horsepower, you know, 4,000. And I guess maybe that would have to be part of the trail.
I don't think we need to have Hummers on the street, frankly. You know, and I wouldn't feel bad telling the few thousand people that own them that they really shouldn't be driving them around. But, you know, we're not talking at this stage about the need to fundamentally transform the United States, nor do I think that's possible. But I think slowly in increments we can increase our reliance on public transportation, and increase our reliance on alternatives and make our cars more fuel efficient, you know, which doesn't hurt.
I think so. Well, we're out of time with Antonia Juhas, and her book is coming out soon. April 25th is the date. It's called The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. And you can go to her website, thebushagenda.net. As usual, Antonia Juhas, thanks for joining me on The Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you so much.
WRIF.com.
She told
Explore Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. I thought we would talk about race. Now, most of us have pretty solid ideas about what race is. We know there's white people, we know there's black people, we know there's Asian, and there's a bunch of people sometimes we call in general like Mexicans or if we're a little bit better than that, Hispanics, right? And associated with those categories are a whole realm of ideas, many of them pretty stupid, some of them making some sense from the cultural configurations that we've been presented with over our lifetime. But there's never really, oh, how can I say it? It's an elusive concept. And let's bring into the conversation my guest today. It's Elliot Lewis. He's written a book called Fade, My Journeys in Multiracial America. And Elliot Lewis is a broadcast journalist. He's on the board of the National Association of Black Journalists. He's done a lot of TV reporting himself. Elliot Lewis, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to be here.
Well, any objection to what I said? I mean, people they have pretty fixed ideas about race, don't they?
Yeah, people do tend to view the racial categories that we've been accustomed to as fairly rigid kind of categories. And, you know, what I have learned through my experience over the years as a person of mixed race is that these categories are not rigid at all. They are quite fluid, and the legal definitions of how we have defined race in the United States has changed over the years, I mean, since the founding of the country till now.
Tell us, actually, I wasn't familiar with, there's actually legal definitions of it all?
Yes, back when racial segregation was the norm and standard operating procedure in this country, various states had varying definitions of what a black person was. If you think back to the days of slavery, we've all heard the stories about how it was not uncommon, for example, for female slaves to have been raped or had some kind of sexual liaison with their slave owner, of course producing many biracial or mixed race slaves. And the question arises, well, what is the legal status of these children who are the offspring of a slave and a slave master? So you had various states coming up with all kinds of different laws to try and quantify the extent of someone's blackness. There were some states that had the rule that if you had one drop of black blood, you were considered black. That was it, end of story. There were other states who had laws that said, well, if you have one-eighth black blood, you are to be considered black. In other states, it was one-quarter black blood to be considered black. This changed over the years, and by about 1915 or so, based on the research that I have read from various scholars, is when the country came to embrace this so-called one-drop rule of black racial identity, that if you have one drop, that is, of black blood, that's enough for you to be considered legally black. That was kind of the general accepted thinking at that time, even though there were these various laws on the books that defined blackness differently.
Now that's completely mad, isn't it, when you think about it? They asked, you may know this story, they asked Papa Doc Duvalier, the dictator of Haiti, how many white people were in his nation, which is seen to be and conceived of as an all-black nation. And he said, white people, we have about 90%. And he said, 90%? He says, yeah, we consider anybody to be white that has a single drop of white blood in them. I mean, obviously throwing this insane way of looking at this category back in the face of the people who constructed this.
Well, exactly. And I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, when you step outside of the United States, you discover that a lot of the racial assumptions that we grow up with here in the United States simply do not make sense in other parts of the world. They define a race differently. So, you know, there are people in the United States who we would consider black, but you take them out of America and put them in, you know, Brazil or Haiti or, you know, some other country, and they're attached with a completely different label.
Well, I mean, it's odd, Elliot Lewis, that this is even a consideration. I'm looking at a handsome photo of you on the back dust jacket of your book, Fade, and I guess I'm thinking of what I heard once from someone, and you'll have to decide whether it applies to you, but I would use that. He said that if you were in the United States, you'd be considered black. If you're in Brazil, you'd be considered white. And if you're in South Africa, you'd be considered colored.
Well, and I would say that those definitions change even within the United States. There's a chapter in my book, Fade, that's called The Chameleon Effect. And that's where I describe how different people have labeled me in various different ways, depending on where their own head is at with respect to race and racial identity. I mean, there are people who look at me and view me as black. There are people who look at me and view me as white. There are people who look at me and view me as Hispanic. I was once in a shopping mall where a Middle Eastern clerk asked me if I was Egyptian. Very early on in my television career, a number of years ago, a television photographer that I was working with came up to me and said that a friend of his had seen me on the air the night before on the 11 p.m. news, and this friend of his had supposedly adjusted the color on his TV set to try and figure out what race I was.
Why does this make such a damn big difference to us? That's maybe a tough question. I don't know if you have an easy or simple answer for it.
Well, I think a lot of people just are not comfortable with the idea of racial ambiguity. And I think on some level, when you have sort of a light caramel complexion like myself, on some level, there is this tendency for people to want to say, you know, tell me what race you are so I know how to categorize you, I know how to classify you in this society, and therefore know how to deal with you.
Well, for instance, you're on the board of the National Association of Black Journalists, mm-hmm. So regardless of the skin hue that you have, you regard yourself as black. So this becomes more, and you tell me, of a cultural and ethnic self-identity category.
Well, I view myself actually as biracial.
Okay.
And the fuller explanation of that is I do consider myself more black than white, but more biracial than anything else. Now, this goes to a very interesting question, because a lot of people assume that when a person says, I'm biracial, and that individual is part black, that we are somehow trying to distance ourselves from the black community, or somehow run away from our blackness, or what have you. In other words, they look at this as kind of an either-or type of situation. Either you're white or you're black, and if you say you're biracial, you're trying to escape being black.
It's the old passing for white deal.
Well, exactly. Yeah. But there are a lot of us who do not see it that way at all. We don't buy into this sort of either-or mentality. We believe in, you know, what scholars, I guess, like to call a both-and mentality. In other words, it's not that I'm neither black nor white. It's that I am both black and white, and I want to be recognized for the fullness of that heritage, and that's why I identify as biracial. I also identify as biracial, quite frankly, because of a lot of these experiences that I've had growing up, where people come up and ask you, you know, what are you? Or people make different assessments based on, you know, what they think your race is. And, you know, that happens to you enough times growing up. I mean, I remember, in the fourth grade, I had, you know, elementary school classmates who were calling me half-breed because of the shade of my skin. So, you know, those type of things happen to you often enough, and pretty soon, you know, you start to question, where you fit in this society. And that's really what's driven my choice to identify as more black than white, but more biracial than anything else. It has nothing to do with trying to escape being black or anything of that nature. It's more about trying to reflect the fullness of my background and the reality of the life experiences that I've had.
Well, empirically, it would seem that the majority of people we identify as being of African ancestry are of mixed race.
Yes, and I talk about that in the book. One of the things that I say in Fade is that there's a distinction that I like to make, in my mind anyway, between being multiracial by birth and being multiracial through life experience. When we look at the African-American population in this country, there are sociologists who will tell you that, you know, 80% or more of the, you know, quote, black population in the United States is actually racially mixed. That if you were to do a family tree on everyone, you could find a white ancestor or a Native American ancestor somewhere in their lineage. But because of the social realities of the world we live in and the times that, that people have grown up in, those folks tended to identify as black. So they are what I call multiracial by birth, but black through life experience.
Yeah, and so then it really is, it's not a scientific category, but it really is a social construct that has been erected for numerous reasons, none that acted well for people of color. I wonder if that wasn't, I'm just musing, I wonder what would happen if we would have been a little more real and decent towards everyone. I guess it would be like, you know, I would have brown eyes and someone else would have blue eyes, if you think about it.
Well, you know, and to, you know, to further on the point that, that I was just making about, you know, people who are multiracial by birth but black through life experience, you know, I am not only multiracial by birth, but I'm multiracial through life experience as well. There are certain, you know, defining moments that have happened to me growing up that have caused me to identify as biracial.
Like what? And, like, give us an example, if you would. And do you talk about this in Fade, your book, My Journeys in Multiracial America? Good. Tell us about it.
Yeah, there are several examples that that I talk about in Fade. One example is when I was somewhere between 10, 11, 12 years old, and my mother took me to introduce me to an uncle that I had never met before. My mom comes from a very large family, so I've got you know, many uncles and cousins and aunts who I, you know, didn't see on a regular basis growing up. So my mom was going over to take me to meet one of my uncles who is dark-skinned. And when she introduced me to him, he did not say a word to me. Instead, he turned to my mother and said, "Where did you get this white boy from?" And, you know, that kind of thing, that makes an impression on a child.
Yeah, I'm sorry, so, I shouldn't laugh because that probably hurt you.
Oh, I was stunned.
Yeah.
I was absolutely in shock. So, you know, when I say, you know, I'm multiracial by birth, but multiracial through life experience, you know, or I should say, when I say that I'm multiracial by birth and multiracial through life experience, those are some of the things that I'm talking about. Now, somebody else might be, you know, multiracial by birth, but black through life experience. They've gone through life with a whole lot of social encounters that have reinforced their blackness. For me, you know, I may have had some of those encounters as well, but I've had other encounters that reinforce my biracial status.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that there's a precious few of people, particularly in the jazz world, that we say that people that were born white but who have lived black. And I was thinking particularly there's an old R&B guy, Johnny Otis, who I always assumed was a very light-skinned African-American. And I was reading about his experiences, and he said he was subjected to discrimination and you know, had a lot of the same experiences culturally that one would expect would occur to an African-American jazz musician like in the 50s. So it's... it's an interesting, and as I said at the beginning, an elusive category. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. My guest is Elliot Lewis. The book is Fade, My Journeys in Multiracial America. It's published by Carroll and Graff. I was wondering, I think someplace in your book you indicate how many people identify on the census as multiracial.
Yes, in the last census, in 2000, there were 6.8 million people who checked more than one racial category to define their race. There was no actual multiracial category on the census. That was an option that was hotly debated and ultimately rejected by the Census Bureau. So instead, the instructions on the form were changed, whereas it used to say check only one racial category. In 2000, 2000, the instructions were changed to read, mark one or more races to indicate what you consider yourself to be.
Now, this is interesting because I suspect the majority of listeners of European ancestry are probably thinking to themselves, well, I'm sure glad I don't have those kind of confusions. I'm all, quote, white, whereas we found out recently through all this DNA stuff that a lot of people who are think that they're, quote, white, turn out to have any number of different strains of ethnicity and so-called race in their genealogy.
And that's why the census question was worded so carefully, because one of the options that was considered was to actually phrase the question by saying, check all that apply. But instead, they chose the language, mark one or more based on what you consider yourself to be. So in other words, if you have black ancestry and white ancestry, but you consider yourself black, then you mark the black box and move on to the next question. If you, say, have white ancestry and Native American ancestry, but the Native American ancestry is so far back, you really don't know much about it, don't relate to it, so on and so forth, and you consider yourself white, then you check white and move on to the next question. Those of us who marked more than one box are people who truly consider ourselves to be more than one race.
I'm checking all of them next time. It probably turned out to be the case with more
do you,
people.
Do you consider yourself to be all of them?
No, I would put none. Can I do that?
You can leave it blank.
I think I have. I find the whole concept. I mean, it's, well, I don't know. Let me. I was going to say, well, since you've had so much experience in journalism, you could interview me. I'll steal all the time away from you, Elliot Lewis. So let's go.
It does, Peter, get to an important political question, though,
sure.
Because you know, there are some people who would rather bypass the question, or when the question is presented to them on you know, enrollment forms at school and so forth, would prefer to bypass the question. But this information is important if we are going to track societal trends, patterns, this sort of thing. I mean, it's through you know, the census questionnaire that we can collect data on racial information and identify where racial disparities exist in societies. We're able to track the growth in the number of interracial families. You know, the National Bone Marrow Registry program has had some difficulty in recruiting a diverse pool of bone marrow donors from communities of color. And so some of this information that is collected on the census when we mark our race can be used to look at, you know, living patterns and other factors, so that in areas where race is an important consideration, that we have that data that we can turn to. You know, if you're going to do a study, for example, on hypertension in African American males over 40.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to have some database to go to find out how many African-American males over 40 do we have, and is there a difference in the rate of hypertension between black males and white males? So gathering this information is important for a number of reasons.
Okay. All right. You convinced me. I'll give the authentic. But again, I mean, these days, you're not even sure. I have a friend of mine, whenever he was forced to respond to religion, would always put in that black John Coltrane. But that's another subject. Let's go on. We haven't even in your book, Fade, My Journeys in Multiracial America, we haven't even talked about any of your journeys. What kind of work did you do for the book, and who did you talk to?
Well, you know, the book is really a recounting of my life experiences growing up and some of these incidents that we've discussed that happened to me, and then some of the people that I met when I tried to make sense of some of my experiences. And the research that has been done on what it's like to grow up in an interracial family and what some of these defining moments are that result in us identifying as multiracial. It was, you know, part of that journey of, you know, meeting other people who were also biracial and then stumbling upon this research that actually said, you know what? You're not crazy. There's a group of psychologists who've done studies on this, and they've discovered that all of these things that you've experienced and all of these things that you were feeling, this is the norm for biracial people. And these experiences are quite typical of people who grow up in interracial families. And it was through that process that I kind of had, you know, one of those aha moments.
Uh-huh.
And found that, you know, that there was a community of people out there who could very much relate to the things that I had been going through, and they in turn had been through some of those very same scenarios themselves.
And you actually did some traveling, though, too.
I did a little bit of traveling for the book, and not a whole lot of traveling specifically for the book, but I have, you know, worked in various markets around the country throughout the course of my television career, and did speak to a number of people in a number of different cities for the book. And, you know, they shared with me a lot of their stories of growing up, not really knowing which race to identify with, or being told that they should identify with one particular race, but then feeling that that didn't quite fit with what their true life experiences were and how they came to embrace a biracial identity. So the book really, you know, takes readers through my own journey and then introduces folks to some of the people who I met along the way. And there's also an interview with one of the leading researchers in the country on this whole issue of racial identity development in multiracial people.
Mm-hmm.
And she has actually found some fascinating differences in terms of generation. There is a huge difference between the way biracial people born in pre-civil rights era America view their identity versus those of us who were born and raised in post-civil rights era America.
Sure. Well, I can imagine that. Still, I was thinking whether to name these people's names who I've interviewed. I think I won't. But I've talked to at least two people that came from a mixed parentage, as they say. And in both cases, the father was African-American. And in both cases, the mother was so-called white and Jewish. And both times, these people identified themselves as black. And I was thinking, wow, actually, they're Jewish. I mean, they, you know, if it's matrilineal, that's, you trace this through the mother, this person could become a citizen of Israel. Yet, they identify themselves as an American black man. So that's when I started thinking that all this stuff about race is crazy, and we all ought to say we're multiracial. But I understand some of the arguments against doing that. I mean, go ahead.
And Peter, it really comes down to, you know, the life experiences that an individual has lived. You know, for example, you know, my parents, both of my parents are biracial. You know, they have black and white ancestry on both sides of their family. But they grew up at a very different time than, you know, the times that I have grown up in. You know, I was born in 1966. So, you know, I mean, the civil rights movement and, you know, all that sort of stuff, by the time I came of age, you know, that was stuff I read about in history books. So, you know, in my parents' case, because of their life experiences, they tended to identify as black. In my case, because of the social realities that have been present during my upbringing, you know, it's been much easier for me, or much more natural for me, to identify as biracial.
You've probably seen, Elliot Lewis, some movies where there'll be, as most movies are, have people that are white in them, and they'll suddenly, someone will come along who is of obvious racially mixed heritage. And every once in a while, I've been noticing lately, that's never an issue. It's not mentioned. I used to think, oh, this is going to have like a racial component to this film. And then the person never does. They just, what amazing. They just interact like human beings. Are we moving? Sometimes I think that, you know, this race thing is going to ultimately sink us. Other times, particularly when I speak with people like yourself, I think, hey, are we finally getting over it? Are we finally beginning to, you know, leave this madness that's haunted us for so long? Which way is it going, do you think?
Well, I think you know, the movement that you're seeing toward more people identifying as multiracial is evidence of the shift that is occurring here by generation. Because when you look at you know, the new generation of multiracial Americans, folks who identify as multiracial, we see that those who were born in the post-civil rights era, particularly those young adults who are in their 20s, who were born, say, after 1980, there is a much stronger trend toward identifying multiracial among that age group than those who were born in the 60s and before, who may have, you know, the same exact parentage. You know, they may have, you know, one parent of who's clearly of one race and another parent who's clearly of another race, but in the pre-civil rights era, the tendency was to identify as black or with the minority race.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you talk to young people and young adults who are in their 20s, and it's not such a an automatic given that they will identify as a member of their minority race. They're much more likely to identify as multiracial. And I think part of that is because you're talking about a generation of adults who are now coming into their own at a time when diversity and multiculturalism has been popular throughout most of their lives. I mean, they have been taught from a very early age that multiculturalism is to be celebrated, that diversity is cool.
Sure.
And that wasn't the case, you know, two or three generations ago.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful point to end things on, optimistically. More from Elliot Lewis in his book, Fade, My Journeys in Multiracial America. There'll be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Elliot Lewis, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Crystal clear HD radio.
What do you think of that?
That's neat. Kind of like Vegas.
101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This
101 WRIF Detroit.
What's up? This is David from Disturbed, and you're rocking with Jay Hudson on 101 WRIF, The Riff.